you're an ice cream cone. You're a lollipop. You're a baby chick. You're a pogo stick. You're a magic trick. You're a spinning top. You're special.
Well, welcome back for another episode of the Neighborhood Archive podcast. As always, I'm very excited to be joined by another special guest today. You may recognize him as the next-door neighbor for a short time to Mr. Rogers when he was at his neighborhood house. He was the proprietor and the namesake behind the Brown's Marionette Theater. And Bob Brown being our guest today, I'm very, very excited to talk with him and learn more about what led to his time on the neighborhood program and what he did during the neighborhood time, as well as what he's been doing since. So, Mr. Brown, I'm very, very glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, if I'm not mistaken, now I went back and looked a little bit, and I believe your first appearance on the neighborhood show was March of 71. Does that sound about right? Or
I'm terrible at dates.
Okay.
That's right.
if I'm not mistaken, it would have been early parts of 71, and then you were on the show for a few years up through, I believe, sometime in 1975.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
And as I mentioned, we're the proprietor of Brown's Marionette Theater next door to Mr. Rogers and his neighborhood. And we got to see several of your productions that you shared the work with your wife, Judy. And so I guess what I'd like to do is I'd like to start even further back, if you don't mind, talking about what led to your time on the neighborhood. So leading up to those years, talk about what did you do how did you get involved with puppetry? What were you doing in those years leading up to Mr. Rogers' neighborhood?
Well, basically, when I was in the fourth grade, I had a teacher who had introduced me to puppets, and I had never seen them before, and I was very shy and very artistic. Mm-hmm. And so this was a great outlet for my creativity, because being shy, I could hide behind a stage, do the puppets, and I never thought of it as anything more than a hobby. Mm-hmm. But I liked it because you could sculpt puppets, you could paint scenery, you could do all kinds of things, you could make costumes, the whole bit. And it involved a lot of craft work that I loved to do. So basically, I kept doing this till high school, and I didn't really take it too seriously, and it all of a sudden it became a job. I was offered a chance to work with a puppet company and go on tour, which I did for a while, and I still thought, it's just a hobby. And a couple of years later, I got to work for Bill Baird. And Bill Baird is the puppeteer who did The Sound of Music.
Okay.
He's probably best known for that. And after I worked for him for a couple of months, he said, get a passport, we're going to India. So we went to India for 3.5 months and toured for the State Department. And then the following year, we went to Russia. Wow. And that was for like almost 4 months. And I went, wow, this is really a cool way to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize it was starting at the top and working my way down instead of working my way up. So kind of fast forward, we were performing at the Smithsonian Puppet Theater.
Mm-hmm.
I originally lived in New York, and I decided it was too hard to raise a family there. So we ended up moving to Virginia because the Smithsonian wanted to start a marionette theater or a puppet theater. We did that, and one of the first performances we did was Peter and the Wolf.
Okay.
And apparently Fred Rogers sent down, I've forgotten his name, Speedy Delivery.
David Newell.
David Newell, little brain in there. David came to see the show. I didn't know who he was. He sort of introduced himself and said he wanted to check out the show, which was fine. And then basically they got in touch with us and told us they wanted us to perform Peter and the Wolf on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, because Fred Rogers wanted kids to know that there was somebody behind puppets,
mm-hmm.
specifically the puppets that he did. However, at the time, he didn't want to tell them it was him. So he wanted to have somebody else move into the neighborhood, in theory, with a puppet theater. However, he wanted to make sure it was marionettes, so that marionettes would look very different from the hand puppets that he worked. So that was a very different look, different feel to it. The problem with the Peter and the Wolf was my wife had made a recording using several different recordings that she blended together, and we couldn't get permission to use it on the air, and it was too expensive to bring in a live orchestra to do the show, and Johnny Costa couldn't play it on the synthesizer or the piano to get the same effect. So Peter and the Wolf was scrapped, and we decided to do Jack and the Beanstalk. So that was our first appearance. Yeah, that was the first show that you saw.
That's really interesting because I know in later years he was very, very open about, you know, bringing the puppets on the screen and showing the puppets. And it's interesting to know that you kind of, you know, you paved the way for those later later appearances, you know, of the actual puppets being shown out of their element and being shown that they're just puppets. And it's interesting to know that you guys were the first ones to try to communicate that to the young audience. So
And of course, you know, he would do things like he'd come and visit the workshop and he would ask how the air conditioning or the heating unit worked, which was very funny because I'm the least mechanical person in the world. And they, you know, they had a real air conditioning unit set up in a heating thing, and I'd open up the front and I'd go, "Well, Mr. Rogers, this is where the compressor is located." They go, "No, no, no, Bob, that's not where the compressor is." I go, "I'm sorry, can we do this again?" And we would do take after take after take. And the thing that's funny is you watch the show, it actually looks like I know what I'm talking about, and I'm totally, totally clueless.
Well, after multiple takes, I'm sure you finally got the right components, right?
Well, if I did it enough times, I did eventually.
So in the times leading up to the neighborhood, you know, you had been doing this for several years, and it sounds to me like you and your wife had been working together for quite some time by this point. Is that correct?
Right, right. Okay. As I said, we started out in New York, and we were doing lots of birthday party shows for kids and holiday shows, you know, Christmas shows type things. But we lived in a small apartment in the Village in New York City, and it was just too hard. So coming down to the Smithsonian gave us an opportunity to expand. And after we left the Smithsonian, we opened our own theater in Washington, D.C., which we ran for a couple of years. And then we decided running a theater was too difficult because it's the old routine, literally, of collecting the tickets, sweeping the floor, doing the show, you know, seating the people. And it was too much of a strain because we were trying to constantly create new shows, and trying to run the theater was just more than we could cope with. So we basically toured for years, and we toured all over the United States, and eventually with our orchestra shows we went overseas. We toured Japan and Hong Kong, all kinds of places, you know, Israel. A couple of years ago we went to Saudi Arabia, which was very, very difficult. Very difficult. I thought it would be an adventure, and it was, but it was not fun. It was very hard. They were rough audiences. They weren't used to sitting still and watching a show, and the kids were just so hyper and so crazy, and it was just
interesting.
Hard.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So for those that don't know, and correct me if I'm wrong, you and your wife were responsible not only for writing your own scripts, you made your own puppets and basically created your shows from scratch. Am I right in saying that?
Yes. After Jack and the Beanstalk, all the shows that were created specifically for Fred Rogers. In one of the shows, The Elves and the Shoemaker, Fred wrote the music and the lyrics to the show, and my wife normally did the script. And sometimes before we went on the air, of course, they would have to check out the script, and some changes were made, things that, you know, they didn't think would play well or whatever. And it was hard because you watch a segment and we're on for maybe 15, 20 minutes of the show. We would have to report to the studio about 8 o'clock in the morning. We usually wouldn't start taping or filming until maybe 10:30 or so. And in some cases, we didn't get out of there till 8 o'clock at night. And we would have like a half an hour or 45 minutes to grab some food, which was usually fast food out of a vending machine in the WTA studios. Not WTA, whatever the...
QED.
Sorry, yeah. I'm thinking of a local station here. So it was hard. And in watching, like, Jack and the Beanstalk, there's a scene where the wolf has got to climb up the roof of one of the houses and go down the chimney.
Right. I actually just covered that episode in the past couple of weeks. I just covered
And I look back on it later on, and I was manipulating the wolf marionette. And I'm going, the manipulation on that is absolutely horrible. And I kept wishing we could do it over again. And I kept thinking, why is it so bad? Well, I realized it was getting close to 8 o'clock at night. We had been going from 10 o'clock in the morning. I was so tired. I was like, just film it and get it done. I don't care. I don't care. I don't care. And, of course, you know, you go back later on, you went, oh, why didn't I take a few more minutes and do that over again? But, you know, the other thing that was difficult is at some point, Fred decided he wanted to have a live audience in the studio, children watching the show. And I kept saying, Fred, it's a mistake. And he went, why? And I said, because children have a short attention span. the shows that we were doing, when we did a story show, it was not filmed in sequence. It was filmed like a movie so that all of the scenes that were the same were filmed together.
Oh, right.
So kids are sitting there watching it, and they couldn't make any sense of it. And plus, after they had been there for a while, they got bored.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so they're, you know, fidgeting in their seats and scratching their butts. And, you know, and it turned into a problem because
sure.
they were trying to get shots of the kids watching the show. And they did that several times. I kept saying, Fred, no, we can't do this with an audience, you know. But you can see several other shows where there's an audience watching, you know, the marionette show. But it was hard. It was hard for the kids. I felt badly for the kids because it made for a long day.
Sure.
You know.
Now, you worked with, it was you and your wife, and then Bob Payne was another gentleman that was always, it seemed like
right.
always by your side. And then just recently,
right.
There were a few episodes that had Susan Bean, which I thank you for, you know, filling in that gap and letting
yeah.
me know who that was because I couldn't make out what her last name was. But
yeah,
so
yeah.
Bob Payne and Susan Bean, were there others that were there?
There were. There was a black guy named Dallas Teach. And the thing that was interesting is when we were on the show, he had had a motorcycle accident. And the motorcycle actually ended up landing on his arm.
Hmm.
So his arm was sort of partially paralyzed. And he had been working for us when this accident happened. And it's very hard to hire a puppeteer who has only use of one hand
sure.
or one arm. But we kept him on because he was a sweet guy and I loved working with him. So I had warned Fred that, you know, there was going to be a little bit of a problem because his arm was going to be in a sling, and it was very obvious. So that was one of the discussions that came up in one of the shows that we did, you know. I guess, why was he sort of a one-handed puppeteer? But he worked for us for a short time. I can't remember who else was on the show because, you know, my career has gone for like 57 years now,
sure.
and there were but. Dozens and dozens and dozens of puppeteers who worked for us. And I can't remember all of their names. And the thing that's funny is a couple of years ago, I was working at this puppet theater, and this young couple brought their three-year-old to come see my show. And they kept acting as if I knew who they were. And I kept sensing that something was wrong, that I should have recognized them, and I didn't have a clue. And they finally said, oh, well, we performed your Nutcracker show. And I said, you did? And they said, yes, as a matter of fact, we met in your studio. And we got married and had this little baby. And I'm like, really? I said, I'm sorry, tell me your names again. Because what would happen very often when we were working on a brand new show, we were always on a tight deadline. We had to get the show finished. And I'd be working, trying to get the puppets finished. And my wife would rehearse with the puppeteers while I was still finishing up puppets. So very often I wouldn't spend much time with the puppeteers who were doing the show.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people that were hired specifically for, you know, the Christmas season or the holiday season. And I wouldn't necessarily see them again. So there were lots of people that I didn't really get to know. And years later, when they showed up, it was like, gee, I'm sorry, I don't remember you. But anyway.
Well, Bob Payne, he went on to work with Jim Henson and the Muppets, didn't he?
He actually worked for the Muppets before he worked for me.
Oh, really?
And I worked at the – I told you – well, I didn't tell you, but when I was in Russia working for the Bears, I got drafted into the Army. And I actually got out a few months early to work at the New York World's Fair. And that's where I met Bob Payne.
Okay.
So Bob Payne worked for me for years. He had started out as a set designer at NBC Studios in Washington, D.C., and he did the original Sam and Friends, which was the first show that Jim Henson did
right,
here in Washington,
right.
D.C. And Jim became famous in Washington, D.C. I had never heard of him because I was living in New York, you know, and he, of course, once he became famous all over the country, then I knew who he was. But Bob Payne worked for me for years and years and years. And he did lots of funny voices for puppets, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the soundtracks for the shows were recorded, and we would always have a problem because when he and I had to work with one another doing voices, he would always do something that would crack me up, and they would have to retake the whole thing because I'd mess up a scene because he would do some silly, ridiculous puppet voice that just, you know, had me laughing hysterically in the studio. So anyway, he was a great puppeteer, yeah.
Along those same lines, what are some things that maybe stand out, maybe some stories or some memories, some favorite
sure.
memories of yours from your time in the neighborhood working, whether that's with the other puppeteers, whether that was working
right.
with Fred or the other cast members from the
right.
neighborhood show?
Well, let me tell you a couple of things about Fred. Fred
sure.
did a couple of things while we were doing shows, and I kept thinking, what the heck is he thinking? And I'll give you an example. One of the sequences we did in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was we had some dancing elephants, and there were two or three elephants in tutus.
Mm-hmm.
And the concept was that these elephants come out and dance, and then there's a little baby elephant who comes out wearing Dr. Denton's, and he's got a little bottle of milk in one hand and a little security blanket in the other hand. And this little baby elephant is trying to keep up with the other elephants, and he can't do it, and he's always out of step, and you know, and it's all done in pantomime to music. And eventually, the little baby elephant walks off sort of wistfully, and the others just kind of watch him walk away. So I was working the baby elephant. We're doing the number. The music is playing, and it finishes. The baby elephant starts to walk off the stage, and Fred jumped up on the marionette stage and said something to the effect, "Wait a minute, come here." And I thought, oh, my God, he's going to start talking to the puppet, which is a problem because I hadn't thought it through. I didn't know what kind of voice I would do. You know, normally if I'm going to do a voice, I practice it or think it through or, you know, have some other puppeteer do the voice if the one I'm doing is inappropriate. And I was in a panic because we're taping this show, and I'm going, oh, my God, please, Fred, don't do this to me. And he said, you look like you're having a hard time. Is that right? And he goes to the elephant. And the elephant's sitting on his lap. Well, fortunately, all the questions that Fred asked the elephant were all answered with yes or no. So I didn't have to do a voice. And this probably lasted, you know, less than a minute or two. But it seemed like eternity because I'm thinking, oh, at some point I'm going to have to, you know, do a voice, and he's going to ask me some stupid question, and I'm going to have to think of a silly answer that sounds appropriate. I just don't ad lib well fast without somebody giving me a warning that that's what we're going to do. And when it walked off, I was like, oh, God. And I said, could I see a playback of the tape? And it was absolutely charming. It was the most charming ending to the routine because he went, you know, it's hard being a little baby elephant when you're trying to keep up with the others, some mm-hmm. words of that effect. And I went, God, that is just brilliant. And another time, we were talking about marionettes, and he said, could you show me how a marionette works?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pulling strings and showing him the controls and stuff, and he went, well, if children wanted to do a marionette, they could do something like this. And we had been doing, that was when we were doing Three Little Pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred reached over on the set and picked up one of the twigs, which was used in the twig house for one of the pigs, and he tied a string on it. And he's dancing the thing, and he goes, you know, you could tie a string on something like a stick like this and turn it into a puppet. Well, while I'm watching Fred, and I'm going, that's the stupidest thing I ever saw. It's really stupid. And then when they played it back, I got to thinking, you know, he's dead on right. Because a child has no concept of all these complicated strings on a marionette and a control. We're talking about, you know, 2-, 3-, 4-year-olds here.
Mm-hmm.
And it made absolute sense. Tie one little string on a stick and make it dance. And at the time he was doing it, I went, what the heck is he doing? And you'd watch a playback, and I'd go, that's fantastic. The other thing I want to tell you real fast is the
sure.
first time I appeared on the show, I didn't know we were going to appear as actors or as ourselves on the show. I thought we were just going to do, you know, marionette scenes, and Fred would say hello, goodbye, and that would be the end of it. There was a scene where I had to talk to what's the hand puppet lion's name? The tiger.
Oh, Daniel Tiger.
Daniel. I'm sorry, Daniel.
Yeah.
So they give me a script and they introduce me to Daniel. I'm supposed to meet Fred's hand puppets. So I'm talking to Daniel, and Daniel has this little toy horse. And I'm going, gee, Daniel, that's a very fine horse. That's a really fine horse. That's a very, very fine horse. And all of a sudden I hear, cut, cut, Bob, could you do that again? And I said, sure. So I do it again. I do it a third time. I do it a fourth time. And when we stopped at one point, I said, you know, I don't really consider myself an actor, and I don't quite know what I'm doing wrong. So could you explain it to me? And they said, well, yeah, it's simple. Sing it. And I said, what? They said, sing it. And I said, why in the hell would I sing it? And they said, because it's a song. And I said, no, it isn't. And they said, yes, it is. And they said, didn't you get the music to the lyrics? And I said, no, and there's no indication in the script that this is a song. And I said, you know, not only can I possibly not act, but I can't sing. And they said, well, sit down with Johnny Costa and we'll go over the music with you. Well, God bless. I mean, I adore Fred, but I couldn't figure out the melody to the song for love nor money. And I kept going, I'm sorry, I just can't follow the beat or whatever it is. And I tried to sing it, and I'm going, oh, this is embarrassing. I said, this is so bad. I can't sing the song. I can't. And they said, okay, just say it. So I'm on the show, and I'm going, you're a very fine horse. You're fine. I look back at it now and I go, oh my God.
Yeah, having just looked at that episode not too long ago, I'll have to go back and give it another look now.
I think they ended up editing some of it out because it was so bad. And the other thing that was funny is on these first couple of takes that I was doing, I was going, gee, Daniel, it's really good to see you. And later on, when we did a playback, I said, you know, I really look like I'm on drugs or on speed or something. I said, I am so hyped up. And I knew it. Why? Because Fred has this very low-key approach, which is great. Mm-hmm. I was used to children's theater where you hype things in front of an audience. You know, you exaggerate or whatever. So I was so over the top. I went, I've got to take that down about 10 notches because I just look like I'm on steroids or something. I'm just crazy. And I'm going, hi, Mr. Rogers. Good to see you, buddy. Take care. It's like, whoa.
You know, and you mentioned his low-key approach. One thing I remember from I looked through your book at one point, and I remember the opening parts of the chapter about working on The Neighborhood mentioned how when you and your wife first met Fred or first arrived in the studio and he welcomed you to The Neighborhood, and your wife said something to the effect of, well, there goes The Neighborhood. And
yeah.
and he stayed very serious and didn't take it as a joke whatsoever.
Well, actually, there were several times where we did things that were inappropriate. You know, and one time on one of the first shows, I think it was Jack and the Beanstalk, mm-hmm. we were doing something, and again, it was getting late, and I was tired, and I either dropped a marionette or I did something, which I almost never do, and I uttered a profanity, which I won't do here because I don't know who your podcast is going out to.
Better safe than sorry.
And everything stopped dead. I mean, it was absolutely silent. And I looked up very slowly and everybody was staring at me. And Fred was sort of on the side. And I said, I'm terribly sorry. I would never, ever, ever swear in front of children. But there were no children in the studio. Mm-hmm. And usually technicians are kind of a little on the raunchy side when you're in theater or TV, you know, and you can joke with them and do all kinds of shtick. Well, apparently, not on Mr. Rogers' set. And I kept saying, I'm terribly sorry. I know that was inappropriate, and it won't happen again. And I thought that would be the end of it. Well, Fred came up, bless his heart. He was like, oh, that's fine, Bob. We understand. It's hard sometimes when you're under distress and you know. And for the next 10 minutes, I listened to this lecture, and I went, oh, that's right, he's a minister. Oh, God. It's like, okay, I'm not going to do that again because I can't stand this lecture. I mean, he was right. He was absolutely right. But it was so funny. I went, God.
What else stands out in your mind about working on The Neighborhood? Any interactions with other cast members, or, you know, I know you mentioned Johnny Costa earlier. Anything else that stands out?
I didn't really get to interact with many people. The one that I found funny was Chef Brockett. Mm-hmm. I don't know why he amused me. A lot of the people on the show, you know, they would do their thing and then they would kind of disappear and that was the end of that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get a chance to socialize with them very much, so I didn't really know them well. You know, I knew of them. Is it Lady Elaine? Is that her name?
Yeah.
Or is that
well, she was one of the characters. I mean, she was one of the puppet characters.
No, who was the lady?
Lady Aberlin? It was
Lady Aberlin.
Betty Aberlin.
Lady Aberlin. I'm sorry, it's been a while.
No, fine.
I should have brushed up on the name.
Oh, no, you're just fine.
Before you interviewed me. She was a doll. I loved her. Mm-hmm. You could tell she had a theater background, and she was lots of fun off camera. But most of them I didn't socialize very much with, you know. You see some scenes where we're interacting with David or whatever, but I didn't really know them. Didn't know them well, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting to hear your take on, you know, like when you said you dropped the puppet and uttered a profanity and things like that, because it just goes to support the idea that I've heard from so many people that the Mr. Rogers, the Fred Rogers you saw on camera, was the Fred Rogers that people interacted with off camera. He was the same person on and off the camera both, that, you know, like you said, that he followed up with you to reassure you and let you know that sometimes things are hard, you know. And
I absolutely adored him. However, our personalities were so opposite that it was almost difficult to work with him sometimes.
Well, that's
he was just so low key for me that I found it hard, and I, you know, and my wife too. And he would do strange things, like he said at one point, "Who makes the costumes?" And I said, "I do." And he said, "Well, we can't have that," or some words to that effect. And I went, "We can't." And he said, "No, no, we'll have your wife say that she makes the costumes." And I went, "She is clueless about how the puppet costumes are made. Absolutely clueless." And it's funny because one of the scenes, my wife Judy is holding up a puppet costume. And she's going, "Well, here is how I sewed this." And I'm going, "She has no clue what she's talking about."
That's why
when you see Fred going into what is supposed to be our studio, there's a picture of a puppet on the sign.
Yeah.
And there's a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, I guess, associating, you know, the Pinocchio thing where marionettes are carved out of wood, or I was a carpenter kind of thing.
Mm.
And again, between my mechanical skills and my carpentry, it's like I'm not a carpenter at all. You know, I'm one of those people that can measure three times, cut once, and still screw it up.
What was his reasoning behind having your wife?
I don't know. I look back at it now and I kept thinking it was so sexist, you know, because there are men who are tailors.
Well, sure. I didn't know if it was just gender roles of the time or if it was.
And I was going to say, you know, and the funny thing is when my wife and I first got married, she was working on a costume for me on a marionette. She had never done costumes before. And we had a cape for a marionette that had to have jewels sewn on it. My wife sat there sewing all these jewels on the cape in her lap, and she went to pick it up and she had sewed the cape to her clothing. And I said, "I don't think God meant you to be a seamstress." I said, "It's okay." And the funny thing is people would go, "Oh, you do such great costumes." And I said, "Actually, I don't, because I would use a staple gun and a glue gun, you know, more than I would sew, because I couldn't sew well." Excuse me. And I would get a lot of stretchy material because I could stretch the material over a puppet's chest or whatever, you know, and I wouldn't have to put darts in it because I didn't know how to do darts on a costume.
Mm-hmm.
So Fred decided my wife was going to be the costumer, which just cracked me up, you know.
So you stayed on the program until roughly 1975, if I'm not mistaken. So where did your career go post 1975? Obviously, if I'm understanding you correctly, you continued to work in addition to the neighborhood during that time, but beyond 75, where has your career gone since that point?
Well, basically, we always did puppet shows for whoever would hire us.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, currently the market seems to be daycare centers.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I also did some work for the Muppets years ago. I did the Ed Sullivan Show, believe it or not.
Hmm.
And people, when you say puppets, people equate it more with the Muppets.
Mm-hmm.
And you say puppet, they immediately think of Elmo or Big Bird or, you know, Kermit, which is great. But the mentality is that puppets are for 2 and 3 year olds.
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be the market for our shows was elementary schools. Now, with all the technology and, you know, the electronic games and things, kids are too sophisticated. And you say puppets, and they go, "Oh, no, no, you know, we've got 6-year-olds. I'm not going to see it for a puppet show." Well, most of the shows I do, 6, 7, 8, 9, even 10-year-olds will sit through the show because I'm using marionettes that are doing very complicated tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Little children will watch it strictly for the entertainment value. They're just watching what the puppet is doing. Older kids are fascinated trying to figure out how the clown hangs from his fingertips on a trapeze and then hangs from his toes,
mm-hmm.
or how a clown blows up a balloon and floats away in the air, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So because when I'm doing the shows, I'm visible. I'm actually, you can see me, you know, performing.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I don't hide behind curtains. And I do that for a reason, because, again, it makes it more interesting. The adults say to me sometimes, "I think you held my interest better than you did with the kids, because I was absolutely fascinated watching your hands, seeing what you're doing." So they're watching it, you know, older kids and adults are watching it on two levels. And I always try to do stuff that I think will intrigue people or fascinate them so that it isn't too babyish, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, a lot of the shows I do now for the daycare centers are things like The Teddy Bear's Picnic, Old McDonald's Farm, you know, that sort of thing. And it's, you know, mostly these shows are marionettes performing and doing tricks to music. I stopped doing story shows. I used to do a lot of story shows because they were very complicated to do. I'd be working several marionettes simultaneously, which is not easy to do, doing all the voices live, having music and sound effects running throughout the show, which I had to control also. And I found, because I'm doing so many daycare centers, little children don't tend to listen very well anymore, and it's become harder to do story shows, especially when you've got a 2 or 3 year old, you know. And for at least 50 years, I'm not kidding, people will call up and go, I want to book a birthday party show for my 1 year old. And I'm going, no, it's not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go, why not? And I say, first of all, they have a short attention span. Second of all, they're going to be crawling all over the place. They're not going to sit still and watch the show. And I said, my shows, in some cases, are interactive, where I'm asking the kids questions and things, and I want them to participate to keep their focus. And, you know, 1 year old's not going to respond. They don't know what I'm talking about.
Right, right.
And I say, save your money and wait until the child is at least 3 years old. And a lot of times they still insist on doing it. And I go, well, if you're going to hang up the phone and turn around and call somebody else, then you might as well hire me, because I think I'm the best in the business, you know. And I keep saying, I'm not trying to talk you out of this, but I want you to be realistic, because especially if it's your first child, you know, and you don't have the experience, you think the child's going to sit there and watch the show. They're not. And I guarantee 9 times out of 10, you know, your fantasy of the child watching the puppet show ain't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm going to lose their attention 5 minutes into the show. And I said, if you're fine with that, I just want you to know, because, you know, it's expensive hiring me to do this show, and I don't want it to be a disaster, you know. And sometimes moms will say, oh, well, the show wasn't very interesting because the kids, you know, didn't hold the kids' attention. That would be because the kids are all 1 and 2 years old.
Right.
You know, it's got nothing to do with the content of the show. So you know, of course, the highlights of my career are when we do orchestra shows. As I said, we travel to Japan. I've been to Singapore, you know, went to Russia, India, did all kinds of things. And those are great because a lot of the shows are specifically for adult audiences. There was a famous conductor named Frubeck de Burgos, and he was a German conductor who studied in Spain, and he did something called Master Peter's Puppet Show. And we created the show specifically for him. And for years and years, we did shows with him. And he, whenever he wanted to do the show, he would take us overseas and we would do it. And he died a few months back. And I said, well, that's going to be the end of the show, because nobody else is going to book it unless I really promote it heavily. And I have not promoted the orchestra shows because, again, my wife used to do the marketing for those, which was difficult enough. But then she would have to arrange to have the show shipped. We had crates made. The stuff would have to be weighed. It would have to be shipped. We'd have to figure out what it was going to cost to let the orchestra know in advance, because they had to pay for the shipping. And it was a whole complicated thing, which I just can't deal with now. So.
Sure. And for those,
so I'm not promoting that anymore.
Right.
But we still, I've got a performance coming up with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. I say performance. We're actually doing 8 or 10 shows. And most of the shows are for children. They bus in school groups. And then on the weekend, it's for a family audience, where we get probably more adults than we get kids. So, yeah. So I'm still doing shows in daycare centers. I do lots of libraries. In the past, I've done shopping malls. I've literally done 3 weddings and a funeral. And that's not a joke. So I said, if it can be done with puppets, I've done it.
And you mentioned, you know, your wife's responsibilities. For those listening, and we did talk about this before we started recording just now, but, you know, Bob's wife, Judy, did pass away a few years ago. And you shared a story with me earlier. If you don't mind, I'd like to maybe kind of revisit that story a little bit before we started recording, where you had mentioned around the time she had passed, that you guys had a show obligation that you carried out, that you fulfilled. And I thought that was a very interesting story.
Yes, so. It sounds like the old "the show must go on" routine.
Sure.
But my wife had colon cancer, and we found out it was stage 4. Mm-hmm. And we didn't really have a problem with it because it was sort of manageable, as difficult as it was. She was never in any pain. And we were supposed to rehearse a performance of Cinderella, which we were going to do in California. And my younger son and my daughter were two of the puppeteers who were going to be in the show. And my wife passed away as my daughter was traveling from New York City, where she lives, to Virginia, where I live. And I didn't want to call her on a cell phone and tell her what happened and mm-hmm. upset her. So when she arrived, I had to announce that, her mom had passed away.
Sure.
and we were going to try to continue doing the show. Well, my daughter was adamant about, no, we have to cancel this. And my son's going, yeah, Dad, we can't do this. And I said, your mother's been working on this for a year and a half, because that's how long it takes sometimes to mm-hmm. work out all the details of doing a show, across the country. So we decided to go ahead and pursue it and do the show. And it took a week or so later till they returned from the show, and it actually worked out really well because it kept them focused mm-hmm. on what they had to do and not think about, we planned a big memorial service afterwards when they got mm-hmm. back from California. And my wife was going to narrate the show mm-hmm. as she had done in the past. And when she passed away, I called the orchestra and I said, we're not going to cancel the show. However, you're going to have to get a narrator. Now, having said that, my son-in-law is named Todd Robbins, and he's a famous magician, and he's done all kinds of stuff on TV. And he was capable of narrating the show. But I said, if you have some local celebrity in California who you can use, it would be a draw for selling tickets. So I said, if there's somebody that can jump in kind of at the last minute, I would recommend doing that. Or we can provide the narrator. So, the show went on, and went on smoothly, fortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, you mentioned, you referred to yourself earlier, and I couldn't agree more from what I've seen, that you're the best in the business.
I'm a legend in my own mind, let's put it that way.
I don't dispute that whatsoever. I don't bring that up to dispute it. I bring that up to say, surely you've been recognized for for various things. I did read that you received a 2008 Virginia Governor's Award for the Arts.
Yes, and I also received a Lifetime Achievement Award from a national organization called the Puppeteers of America. Mm-hmm. I've got a whole wall full of awards, which really don't mean anything. It's very nice to be acknowledged by your peers, but I don't take it too seriously. I know there's a lot of puppeteers that, take this all very seriously, and I'm like, oh, it is what it is. I said, my biggest thing is most puppeteers want other puppeteers to acknowledge their work. And I did for years and years, and now I'm going, as long as audiences keep paying and coming to see my shows, that's all I care about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what other puppeteers think of my work or, other people. And I'm currently working in a place called the Puppet Company Playhouse, which is in Glen Echo, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
There's an amusement park that dates back to the turn of the century, and it closed in the 1950s because of segregation. And then it kind of reopened as kind of a hippy-dippy, arts and crafts type place.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a permanent puppet theater there. And the shows that they do they do these fantastic productions, but they'll do things like, to give you an example, Jungle Book.
Okay.
And when the show starts, the lights go down to blue because it's supposed to be a nighttime scene. And all of a sudden, these life-size cougars and leopards come walking out on stage and their eyes light up in the dark. Well, what happens is when they do these shows, most of their shows, they say, we do not recommend this show for children under 5. And the audience will say, why? And they go, well, it's a little bit too intense, a little bit scary. So we recommend 5 and up. Well, every parent of a 3-year-old will argue that their child is sophisticated and they take them to the ballet and the opera. And of course they're going to love the show. And they go in and the kids absolutely freak out because they're scared to death.
Sure.
Or the witch gets pushed into the oven, the oven explodes, the witch screams, and the 2-year-olds are, screaming for mommy. And the theater's dark, so they're scared.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, look, I've got wonderful shows. As I mentioned, Teddy Bear's Picnic, Old McDonald's Farm, there's a show called Clowning Around, which is about the circus. I said, it's really appropriate for young children. There's nothing scary. There's nothing frightening. And it's a perfect solution to, you know, get the younger kids into a separate show. And then don't make the theater completely dark. Keep the lights on halfway, you know. And that's proved to be a tremendous success in most of the shows. And I only work on the weekends for them. Mm. Most of the shows have sold out. Mm. And we have over 200 people at almost every show.
Wow, that's great.
Which is fantastic. Yeah, yeah. So I'm just happy to be doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, going to some of the questions that folks had submitted through our Facebook page and through other means, you know, a lot of those we've covered, things like, you know, your favorite memories of working in the neighborhood, you know, how you got involved with that. But one of the questions that we haven't covered that came from a gentleman that I've gotten to know through our website. His name's Danny LeBrec, and he does some work with young children through a show called Treehouse. And he said, he told me he has just gotten started with working with marionettes. But his question for you, he said to ask you about the technical side of expressing complex emotions through string movement, because he had mentioned how he has a hard time, or he's having a hard time learning, you know, the manipulations to express emotions through the string puppets. As his, you know, I guess in the past, his work has mostly been with hand puppets and otherwise. So any advice for Danny when it comes to expressing emotion through marionettes?
Ooh, that's kind of a hard one, because I'm not sure exactly what it is he's trying to do specifically. Mm-hmm. The first thing you've got going against you, most, not all, do not have moving eyes or mouth or eyebrows.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't really have any facial expressions. They have just a fixed, painted expression. So you have to rely on mime. And it can't be too subtle. For instance, there's a show where I've got a clown who's trying to blow up a balloon and he can't do it. And I go, oh, I'm sorry. And what happens is he sort of leans his head against my leg, the calf of my leg,
mm-hmm.
and acts like he's crying. And that is because, first of all, I cover up the face,
mm-hmm.
you know, by him sort of burying his face in my leg. And I put his hand up to kind of cover the face. And then I kind of shake or vibrate, I guess you almost might call it vibrating, the shoulder strings, so it looks like he's sobbing a little bit. And I go, wait a minute, buddy, sometimes two can do the job better than one. And then I grab this tube that comes out of the back of the puppet, and I'm helping him blow up the balloon. Because
mm-hmm.
kids would say sometimes, oh, we can see you're blowing up the, you know, you're actually blowing up the balloon through a tube.
Mm-hmm.
And by saying, I'm going to go help you, and the two of us are going to work on it together, it kind of, you know, eliminates that.
Sure.
We can see you doing it. But, I, you know, it's really, if a puppet is happy, it's like skipping or whatever you would do. It's theater, really.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know what he's trying to do. I'm assuming he's trying to do story shows where he's trying to express emotion. And a lot of that's done vocally.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it. When we did audio tracks, or we recorded our shows, I always said, think of it, and of course you have to be of a certain age, think of it as a radio show, because you're overacting. You have to compensate for the fact that the puppet has a lack of facial expressions.
Mm-hmm.
So when you would sob, that's what I was talking about before, I'm working with Fred, you're overacting a little bit. And you can't do that on television, because it just comes across as, you know, overblown, I guess is the best way to put it. So a lot of it is done in your voice. If a character is sad, you know, you kind of lower your voice and speak a little bit slower. So that's the only advice I can give him on that.
Okay.
You can't, there isn't much you can do with strings, adding strings. You know, you can do a special string that will maybe bring the puppet's hands to its hips, or bring a puppet's mouth, a hand to its mouth. Those are special strings that you need to do, which he would may or may not know about. But it's really acting, and it's mime
mm-hmm.
more than anything else.
Okay.
You know, so it's sort of knowing theater and knowing mime a little bit. Yeah.
So if people want to look into the world of Bob Brown puppets, you've got a website, which is BobBrownPuppets.com.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, you're on Facebook as well. Maybe not often, but you do have a Facebook page.
Either my daughter or friends will post things on Facebook for me.
I did find a Facebook page. It was Facebook.com, of course, and then Bob Brown Puppet with no S on the end. Bob Brown Puppet.
Yes. However, let me tell you something real fast about that.
Sure, sure.
I had a discussion with my son and my daughter recently. A few years ago, I was doing a show at a library, and it was a show called Dragon Feathers, which is a puppet show about dragons. And normally, before I do these shows, I'll say, I would appreciate if you would not videotape the shows. And in this particular instance, I didn't do that. And somebody videotaped the entire show, and they were sitting way on the sidelines. And it happened to be, and this is rare, but it happened to be one of those shows where the kids were a little bit too young. They were getting antsy. They were not reacting well. The show was not going well. And there are times when you go, you know, I'm doing the best job I can, but the circumstances are working against me. Mm-hmm. So the kids were just acting up a little bit, and, you know, and this person videotaped the entire show without my knowledge, which was fine, except they posted it on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while I go, when you type in Bob Puppets, if you see this library show with the dragons in it, it's not representative of my work. But there's another video which somebody did when we were doing Master Peter's Puppet Show. Mm-hmm. And we were working, I think, with the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. And somebody came backstage and said, may I just videotape a little bit? And I said, sure. And I thought, well, this is weird, because I couldn't imagine what he was going to tape backstage, because backstage is not as interesting as it is watching the show from the front. But he did a little, 5-minute clip or less that's absolutely charming, that gives you an idea of the scope of these puppets, because mm-hmm. some of them are like 8 feet, 10 feet tall. So we're not talking about a little tiny puppet show, you know. So it shows kind of some of the scope of our work.
Mm-hmm. Is that video available online? Is that one that we can find on?
If you type in Bob Brown Puppets, uh-huh. and you type in Master Peter's Puppet Show or the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra Master Peter's Puppet Show, it comes up.
Okay, yeah. I'll have to put a link up for others to watch that, because I did notice that there were a handful of videos on YouTube of just short clips of your shows and maybe not shows in their entirety, but just short clips of people who had visited your shows. So I'll have to look for this one.
I'm bound to determine I'm going to get some video clips on YouTube eventually, because, mm-hmm. you know, I've got some clever routines that I do that, you know, I don't think any other puppeteer has done, which I would like to get out there and show. I've also invented some puppets that do tricks years and years ago, which have since been copied. And it's funny, because I recently saw a puppeteer, I think, in Singapore on YouTube, and I'm going, wait a minute, that's my act. So I keep thinking, I want to document some of these ideas that have come up with recently mm-hmm. on YouTube. Okay. So I can say, you know, not that I'm going to be around long enough, but I can say, look, I invented that in 1980. <You know? laughs> So I'm going to learn how to document some of my things on YouTube.
Well, one other place that I know people can learn more about you and about your career is through a book that is one of my favorite titles I think I've ever seen on a book is A Pair of Cockeyed Optimists, the Puppetry and Careers of Bob and Judy Brown. I think it's a fantastic title. And I believe this is available through Amazon, is it not?
It is, yes.
Okay,
is.
And we can get a link up to that as well. I think it's linked off of your website also.
I think so.
And we can.
And it's unfortunate, because there were so many stories that we had to tell, and we didn't have time to do them all. And my wife actually wrote 90% of that. And we had planned on doing several more books, because we had enough stories that were interesting and crazy. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking, you would not believe some of the things we've done with puppets. You know, people think of, oh, cute little puppet show at a birthday party show mm-hmm. or whatever. And we've done things that were just unbelievable. And I kept thinking, we've got to document some of the stuff. I mean, commercials and things that we've done that, mm-hmm. you know, misfired and didn't work, or, you know. But unfortunately, I'm not a writer, so I don't think we're going to get a second chapter. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of funny things in that book.
Yeah. Well, I think we can wrap up with one quote that I read.
Sure.
In fact, it's a quote from your wife that was in an article I read, where she was quoted as saying, puppetry is the last place in our society where you can do your own thing.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that? If you could kind of expand on that a little bit and tell me what you think in relation to that quote.
Well, first of all, anybody who's an artist of any type, you know, a dancer, or, you know, painter, whatever, it's a very, very difficult way to make a living. It really is. Mm-hmm. And there are times when I say to myself, well, why am I doing this to myself? But, you know, you're free to do what you want. Of course, there are limitations, and because I'm in the Washington, D.C. area and everybody's politically correct, I have to be very, very careful about what I put in shows, make sure there isn't anything that would offend somebody or that they might misinterpret, you know. But it's great because I get to work my own hours, you know, and I'm working all the time. People go, well, you're so successful. And I go, well, the reason being, because when I'm not performing and doing a show, I'm building new shows. Or, you know, my wife used to run the office and she would, you know, book the shows and all. So now I do a show and I have to come home and I have to answer emails, and I usually have a ton of them. And then there's voicemail on my phone, so I have to return phone calls. So very often my day will go from, you know, 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning until 8 o'clock at night when I'm still working on puppets or coming up with new ideas or whatever. So, but I love it. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't be doing it if I weren't enjoying it. And the thing that gets me is occasionally I've done shows for kids with special needs, you know, and I'm doing the show and I'm going, oh, this is such a difficult audience, because sometimes a child will scream and I don't know if they're screaming in fear or joy. I literally can't tell. And I remember doing a couple of shows where I went, oh, God, said to the person who hired me, that didn't go well. And they said, actually, it did. There was a little child who couldn't communicate or couldn't walk, who actually walked to the show to come see the puppet show, and was getting, they were getting these fantastic reactions from this child, which I couldn't tell from my perspective. I kept going, it, you know, it didn't go well. And they said, yeah, the kids are still talking about your show, you know, an hour later. So things like that, that's really why you're not doing it for the money, you know, because you never get rich in this profession. The only one who got rich was Jim Henson, and that's a fluke. That's not going to happen for a long time.
Yeah.
Most puppeteers are struggling, but you do your own thing and you enjoy it, you know. Such you were going to quote, is some years ago, some gentleman called up and was haggling back and forth with my wife about the price of a show. Because he thought we were charging too much. And at one point he was saying, well, how much do you charge by the hour? My wife said, well, we don't really charge by the hour. We charge a flat fee. And, you know, you may be getting a show that's only a half an hour or 45 minutes long, but you might live an hour away from us. So there's an hour traveling there and an hour traveling back. It takes us, you know, a half an hour or so to set up the show, a half an hour to strike it. So you're really paying for 4 or 5 hours of work for this one puppet show. And the guy said to her, well, you know, my brother-in-law is a brain surgeon, and he doesn't make that much money per hour. My wife said, well, that's why we gave up brain surgery and became puppeteers. And I loved that line. For years I was quoting that.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So that's why I'm not a brain surgeon, because I make more money as a puppeteer.
Exactly.
I wish.
Exactly. Gosh. Anything else for the good of the cause that you would want to share with the listeners?
Not that I can think of offhand. I mean, it was a great experience. And the funny thing is, you know, when we did the show, I just thought of it as another project, and as I did of a lot of other things. And I look back on it now and I'm going, you know, it was great. It was great fun doing it. I love the fact that I've got those videotapes for my grandson and I can look back on it and laugh at some of the things. It was great fun doing it, and I didn't think it – well, I'll tell you something real quick again.
Sure.
I know you're trying to cut this short.
No, you're fine. You're fine.
My son, I told you, was about 3 years old on one of the programs, and Fred decided he wanted him to be making some puppets with us. So fast forward. They were running the show for 25 years. They were doing reruns. My son Michael gets a call from a friend of his saying, Michael, turn on the TV, turn on Mr. Rogers. And Michael said, why? And he said, because there's a couple of people on there like hippies or something, and they're puppeteers. You know, the guy's got long hair and, you know, he's a puppeteer, and they've got some kid on with them. So go watch it. So Michael turns on the TV and goes back to the phone and says, yeah, that's me. And the guy goes, no. It's like a little kid. He's like 2 or 3 years old. And Michael's going, that's me. And he says, no. He said, that's me 25, 30 years ago.
Nice.
when we taped the show. So, you know, so you have no idea that 25 years later, this is going to come back to haunt you. And my daughter recently posted that clip on Facebook of my son making puppets at 3 years old on the show. So, yeah, it was great fun working with Fred Rogers. Yeah, I loved it.
Well, Well, I'm really appreciative of your time this afternoon. Bob Brown
Not
of Bob Brown of Bob Brown's Puppets. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.